I just assumed.
I said I need to get in on a multitask.
Here as well. People can't do that, but I think I'm under.
See, they have a privacy caveat.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, we typically.
Okay.
Tim and I talked about it. We're supposed to.
Thank you. Well, it's still good morning for another couple minutes. This is
morning.
Item 9. You have the floor for the next 30 minutes, so if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, and we'll start the presentation there.
Great. Good morning.
Oh, and I'm sorry. Another member brought this up. There is a confidentiality clause in your materials. Just this is a public meeting. You're okay with the materials being made public?
Yes, we understand, but thank you for pointing that out.
Okay. Now the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the invitation to come present to you today. And we are very excited to introduce our firm, AQR Capital Management, and the strategy that we manage, which is called the Global Risk Premium Enhanced Liquidity Fund. My name is Joey Lee. I cover investors on the West Coast for AQR, and I've been with the company for 10 years. And my colleague, Yaohua Ui, is a portfolio manager on the fund we are discussing today, is a principal of the firm, and in his 12 years at AQR, has written numerous papers that have been published in both in academic and practitioner investment journals. Now, if you turn to page 5 of the materials you have in front of you, as I mentioned, the strategy that we're discussing today is the Global Risk Premium Enhanced Liquidity Fund. Quite a mouthful. So you'll hear us refer to it as our GRPEL portfolio for short. And it's motivated by one of the most foundational principles in investing, which is that there is no free lunch in finance except for diversification. And this strategy sits within a category of funds that are commonly referred to as risk parity portfolios, which I understand your consultant Veris and Tim and the rest of the team have presented to you before in terms of from an educational perspective. We have 12 years of experience managing risk parity portfolios. Our first risk parity fund was launched in 2006. So we've managed these strategies through various market cycles, including through the financial crisis. And the foundation here is really to meet two criteria. One, build a risk diversified portfolio, and two, keep it that way through time. As a firm, if you look at page 6, we have been managing assets for institutional investors since the founding of AQR in 1998. So 20 years of experience working with your peers across the country, and we do work with a number of California counties as well. Within all the strategies that we manage at AQR, we use a very first-order principle of being systematically oriented and research-based. With our interactions with our clients and investors, we have a couple of goals. First is to be transparent in what we share. The second is to be intellectually honest. And the third is to be outcomes oriented. And in the business that we currently have at the firm on page 7, we manage approximately $226 billion in assets, and specifically within the risk parity space, close to $30 billion.
How many clients would you say that is?
It's in the hundreds. Okay. It's in the hundreds. So we have investors that have over $1 billion with us in risk parity, and we have investors who have less than $5 million. As I mentioned, we have about $30 billion in risk parity assets currently, which makes it a very core part of our overall business at the firm. And on page 8, you'll see our organizational structure. We have a very robust front office and back office infrastructure that's based in our headquarters in Greenwich, Connecticut, reflecting the quality of the investors that we have across our firm strategies. And we have 35 principals that you can see are represented across the organization, which is important to us because our firm is actually majority owned by the 35 partners. So we retain control of our portfolio construction process and investment decisions, as well as our hiring and firing choices. With respect to the team that runs the GRPEL fund, you'll see that laid out on page 9. The main portfolio managers for this fund are listed across the top there, and you'll see Yahua's name among the four PMs that are responsible for the day-to-day performance and portfolio construction and management of the strategy. And importantly, as a reflection of our firm's commitment to the risk parity space, you'll notice that every four of those portfolio managers are also principals or partners of our firm. And in addition, that portfolio management team is supported by over 150 people who are part of our trading, portfolio implementation, risk management, and technology teams. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Yahua, unless you have any questions about the organization.
One. In the last year, have you lost any clients?
Within the strategy, we have had some redemptions. It's possible that we could have lost a client. As I mentioned earlier, we have well over 100, probably north of that.
What I'm talking about is something that you would have noticed. Have you lost 15 clients? Have you lost 10 clients?
No.
Okay.
I would say the business in the risk parity asset space has been relatively stable for the last few years. If you look at our risk parity assets that we've managed at the firm, it's been at about that $30 billion level for the last 3 or 4 years. So some slight fluctuations, but no major group of investors either redeeming or coming in over the last few years.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so thanks for the introduction, Joey, and again, thanks for the time this morning. I'm gonna try to keep my comments focused on the investment strategy. I know you have heard about investment philosophy and the case for it from Verus, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that. I'm going to focus mainly on how AQR implements the strategy and some of the things that are differentiating about our approach in the risk parity space. Welcome any questions along the way, so definitely feel free to interrupt if you do have questions that you want or anything that you want to get into more detail on. So starting from page 11, just a quick refresher on the investment goal of this strategy. So as Joey pointed out, what we're trying to do here is to take advantage of diversification, mainly across global asset classes, and try to build a portfolio that has a high risk-adjusted return. So really, to us, risk parity represents sort of our best way of doing asset allocation in a long-only liquid space. I would say one of the things that makes risk parity unique is its focus on diversification by risk rather than by dollars. Again, this is something that you may have already heard of. Rather than looking at how many dollars are allocated to each asset class, we really focus on where the risks of the portfolio lie and try to make it more balanced than a more traditional portfolio. I think where AQR is differentiated in its implementation is really the last point on page 11, which is this idea of trying to keep this diversification stable at all times. And what that really means is that we take a view that market risks and market conditions are dynamic. Meaning that if you look at the world today and asset classes, how they behave today, the picture is quite different versus 2008. For example, volatility in markets are much lower today than they were in 2008. And relative differences in volatility across these different asset classes are also quite different today. So as we get into the presentation, I'll try to give some examples of how our approach ends up being quite dynamic in shifting our holdings across these various asset classes to try to preserve the stability of the diversification in our portfolio, even as markets change. And that's one thing that we spend a lot of our research and our focus doing. Page 12 is a quick chart that shows the risk that's inherent in a more traditional 60-40-like portfolio. You can see that a traditional portfolio that has 60% of its capital in equities and 40% in other asset classes on the left-hand side pie chart. Ends up looking quite concentrated from a risk perspective in equities, and that's really because equities tend to have a lot more volatility or risk associated with them, so that every dollar you put in it actually has a much bigger impact on how the portfolio behaves than a dollar in bonds. And we think that's one of the weaknesses of a more traditional approach. It is a very common approach that most people take on, but it does make portfolios very reliant on equities doing well. So in other words, the traditional portfolio tends to do best when growth is strong in the economy and when inflation is quite modest. And that's one of the environments that we've been in, fortunately, for the last 7 or 8 years now. But we do think that there is room for improvement in trying to take advantage of building a more diversified portfolio that can withstand and do better in a wider variety of economic outcomes. One of the other challenges with a more equity-concentrated portfolio, you can see on page 13, is precisely that because it is very dependent on one single type of investment doing well, it tends to suffer greatly when equities go through a very tough time. So page 13 just points out, in the last 50 years or so, during the three most difficult periods for traditional equity markets, a traditional 60-40 portfolio suffered losses that were quite large, ranging from about 20 to over 30% in those environments. Page 14 also shows another characteristic of traditional portfolios that are related to the drawdowns. And really what page 14 tries to illustrate is the fact that a traditional 60-40 portfolio, while it while most people think of it as a portfolio that has a moderate or sort of pretty modest level of risk, you can see from page 14 that in certain periods, again like in 2008 or 2011, when equity markets are going through a tough time, that the realization of volatility in that traditional portfolio can sometimes be two or three times higher than what we normally expect. And we think that is, a feature of the traditional portfolio that is less than ideal, because it leads to a high level of discomfort amongst investors when they start seeing portfolios move around, especially in the downside, in much larger magnitudes than we're used to expecting. That can lead to suboptimal investment decisions and behavior. And so what AQR is trying to do with our GRPEL strategy is to really tackle both of these problems head on, the lack of diversification and the over-reliance on equities, as well as the lack of risk control or risk management inherent in a more traditional approach. If you look at page 15, you'll see that in contrast to a traditional portfolio that has, call it 80 to 90% of its risk in equities, the strategy that we've constructed has only one-third of its risk in equities, and the other two-thirds of its risk evenly split across bonds and inflation-sensitive assets, which for us includes commodities and tips. And the reason why we've chose to design the portfolio this way is because, based on our research, we find that the expected historical Sharpe ratios, or risk-adjusted returns, for these three different categories are more similar than different, and on top of that, they are very diversifying to one another. So by combining them in an equal risk-weighted fashion, we believe that we can build an overall portfolio that has a higher risk-adjusted return than concentrating in any one of the three asset classes, and is more likely to produce a smoother ride across many different economic outcomes.
How would you differentiate the equities being, they're obviously inflation-driven as well, compared to the inflation-sensitive assets? Like, how do you defer them? Is it strictly the commodities you're talking about?
Yeah, so the way that we differentiate here, equities here would include equity index exposure in emerging markets, developed markets, just direct equity exposure. The inflation bucket here, while equities do have some sensitivity to inflation, we do not include them in our inflation-sensitive bucket. The only asset classes that we hold within this particular risk allocation are commodities and tips.
Okay.
So page 16 shows you some of the outcomes that we hope to achieve with this more diversified, more risk-balanced portfolio. 16 is showing that same time periods where the traditional portfolio experienced these large losses when equities did poorly. And the blue bars on page 16 show you how a risk parity portfolio that's equally balanced across stocks, bonds, and inflation assets fared in those similar environments. And you can see that by and large, the drawdowns that were incurred in those periods were much more shallow, and in fact, in the 2000-2002 period, due to the strong performance of the remaining two asset classes, bonds and commodities, we actually saw a positive outcome for the risk parity portfolio in that environment. So our belief is that a more diversified portfolio is going to help your overall portfolio become more diversified and become a little bit less reliant on equities. In essence, we're trying to reduce the amount of equities that you hold overall and increase the exposure to bonds and inflation assets that can do that can perform differently when equities do poorly. Page 17 is another graph here that, again, is in contrast to what we saw earlier with the realized volatility for the 60-40 portfolio. When we look at the bottom graph on page 17, what we're showing here is the realized volatility of our GRPEL fund over the past 12 years or so. And what we're trying to achieve, as a reminder, is we're trying to keep the portfolio risk more stable through time. And given that the portfolio is targeting about 10% annualized volatility, in a perfect world, we would be able to show a graph that shows that our realized volatility was exactly 10% every single quarter. Now, in practice, you can see on the page here that we're unable to achieve such an outcome. We do not have perfect foresight in being able to know everything that's going to happen to markets, but we are able to build models that do a pretty good job in controlling the risk of the portfolio, such that the outcomes we've realized over the past 12 years have been much closer to our targeted level of volatility compared to a less risk-managed approach, like the 60-40.
Do you have an average volatility of both?
Yes, so the average volatility of both these portfolios over the long term is roughly 10% a year.
Over those being equal?
Yes, so over the long term, we expect a global 60-40 portfolio to realize about a 10% annualized volatility, and the same is true for our strategy over the long term on average. The difference lies in
the spread then, basically.
Yeah, the difference lies in terms of how much variation there is. So if you look at the two graphs, the average is about the same, but the sort of ranges of outcomes are much more narrow for our approach versus the 60-40 approach. So the goal is to try to realize a similar level of risk as a traditional 60-40, but try to do so in a more controlled way. And the main benefit of, if we can achieve that, the main benefit to you is that you can expect the portfolio to behave in a more controlled manner, and especially when markets go through difficult times, we expect that this risk management aspect can help mitigate the magnitude of the drawdowns that the fund experiences. And that's really the main benefit. We tend to see that from, in most financial markets, that large drawdowns tend to occur when portfolios exhibit larger than average volatility. So if we can do a good job trying to dampen heightened volatility when markets get more volatile, we can try to achieve more shallow drawdowns in those environments. And that's a key feature of our process. And I'll spend another minute on this because this is really important. Just in case you're wondering, well, how can you control volatility? This comes back to the main way we try to construct this portfolio. We run a systematic process that tries to forecast the risk level of all the three asset classes that we invest in on a daily basis. So we have models that we build that try to forecast what equity volatility, what bond volatility, and what commodity volatility will look like on a forward-looking basis. And again, we don't have a crystal ball, so we're not able to, for example, predict the next market crash or the next geopolitical event that is out of the blue. However, what our models can do is react very quickly to information that is getting priced into markets as we speak, and we're able to use that information to make good forecasts about what is going to happen in the future. And it turns out from our research that we find that volatility tends to be quite persistent. So for example, if we were sitting in this room back in 2008 and stock markets were moving 3-4% easily a day, our models show that it's likely that when you're in that kind of environment, volatility is more likely to stay high than to go back to normal levels very quickly. In contrast, because we've been in this much more subdued volatility environment for most asset classes today, our models are forecasting that risk or volatility will tend to be more stable at the moment. And until things change, our models will behave as such. Okay. So page 18 on the following slide, just again trying to illustrate why we think this risk parity approach has a long-term benefit to your overall asset allocation and overall portfolio. It comes back down to this expected improvement from diversification. If you go from left to right, you'll see that the expected risk-adjusted return that we can obtain from a 100% equity portfolio is improved when we add some bonds to the mix. But that, as we mentioned, because of the high concentration in equities, because most of the risk in that 60-40 portfolio is still in equities, the magnitude of diversification improvement is quite small. When we go to what we're trying to do, which is on the right side, more of a risk balance construction and also adding a significant component to inflation assets that are not represented in the 60-40 portfolio, we can see that we can hope to gain a larger improvement in the portfolio's overall risk-adjusted return because these three asset classes are all very diversified to one another. So on the next page, you can take a look at the three major asset classes, the equity risk, bonds, and inflation risk. And you can see the full list of the individual markets that the fund is invested in. And this list is quite stable through time. We have added a few exposures through the years to try to, as we continue to find markets that are more liquid. But the basic idea is to try to maximize diversification, both by equal risk balancing across the three asset classes, but also within the asset classes, trying to stay very much globally diversified, trying to have broad exposure to many geographies, many countries, and avoid being concentrated in any one single region or one single asset. So if you look at our equity risk bucket, you'll see that we are well represented, both in terms of the developed markets that we're invested in, as well as the emerging markets. You can see that our developed bond exposure contains six of the largest, most liquid bond markets out there. And then lastly, in the inflation risk bucket, we have exposure to both inflation-linked bonds around the world, as well as commodity futures that are spread across many different sectors. And so the idea is, our belief is that over the long term, each of these investments or each of these asset classes should generate a positive return over time, and that these returns should be obtained at different times from one another. So again, at the point of diversification, the hope is that over the long term, what you'll see is that all three different asset classes add positively to the fund's return, but they perform well and poorly at different times.
I had a question on the inflation risk. Three things. One is, what are lean hogs and Brent oil? And then the third one is unleaded gas. I didn't realize that was actually a commodity.
Yes. So happy to, yeah. So there's a number of different energy-related futures contracts that are available for that are very liquid. So Brent oil is simply it's crude oil, the same thing that you think of when you think of crude oil. However, its delivery point is in Europe. So it tends to be priced at a spread to the U.S. Brent oil, U.S. crude oil market, typically a little bit higher these days, but very much the same commodity. Unleaded gasoline is basically processed, refined crude oil that can be used for driving. So that is also a liquid commodity. And again, that trades at a little bit of a premium to crude oil because it has been refined and processed. And then lastly, lean hogs is basically, back in the commodity world, it used to be pork bellies that were a liquid futures contract that no longer, it's still a futures contract. If you've seen trading places, that's one of the contracts that was very much a liquid contract back in the 70s. But today, lean hogs is basically pork. So it's sort of the liquid commodity that's a proxy for pork, along with live cattle, which is a proxy for beef. So we don't take delivery of any of these. We only get economic exposure to them. So.
Got it. Thank you.
And one of the things that I think is important to think about is that the portfolio is long in all these asset classes. So keep in mind, while we believe that we're well diversified, it's very important to note that that doesn't mean that the portfolio never goes through tough times, right? There are going to be periods, and we saw 2008 was one of them, where multiple of these asset classes were losing money at the same time. So while this strategy is designed to try to not be too dependent on one single asset class, there are going to be environments where multiple asset classes lose money at the same time, and that could lead the entire fund to be down in that particular period. But our hope is that over the long term, each of these individual pieces should generate a positive return on average. And because they're diversifying to each other, the whole portfolio should behave in a more stable way versus just investing in a single one of these asset classes. I'll spend a few minutes on page 21. Page 21 is really important because it gives you some real-life examples of how our AQR's approach to managing risk parity can lead to some pretty different holdings within our portfolio, depending on the risk environment for the different asset classes. So there are a lot of numbers here, so I'll go through this a little more slowly. On page 21, what we're trying to show here is the holdings that a risk parity portfolio like ours would have in each of these time periods. So in other words, if you look, let's start from the left-hand side. If we were in October 1980, now we weren't running risk parity back then, but this is based on a simulation, if we had $100 in risk parity, these would be the dollar exposures that the portfolio would be holding. It would be holding $47 in equities, $36 in bonds, and $42 in commodities.
That adds up to more than 100.
It sure does.
Yes. So one of the reasons that you'll find, and this is common across all risk parity providers, is that if you look at the holdings that the fund has, there is the use of leverage.
This is plus leverage gets there, to the total.
Yes. All right. And the reason why all risk parity providers end up having to use some leverage in the portfolio is because when you start to try to make things risk balance, inevitably, what you end up doing is you need to have larger holdings in your lower risk assets. So for example, in today's world, that would be bonds. So a more risk balanced portfolio would have a lot more bonds than stocks. You can see that, for example, in the 2014 example. If you look at the right side, right, you can see the fixed income dollar holdings are much higher than the equity holdings. And that's because, again, every dollar that you put into bonds tends to move around a lot less than a dollar that you put in stocks. So if you want the portfolio to be balanced from a risk perspective, you need to invest in a lot more bonds than stocks. And the reason why risk parity strategies end up using leverage is because if you have a lot of bonds and very little in equities, that entire portfolio, if unlevered, like for example, an 80-20 bond stock or 20-80 stock bond portfolio, would have a pretty low level of risk associated with it. And while that lower risk portfolio would be more balanced and have a higher risk-adjusted return, it would have too low of a return expectation that would meet your investment goals. And so leverage is often applied to these strategies in order to get the risk of the portfolio back to a similar level as a 60-40 portfolio. So in other words, an unlevered risk parity portfolio might only give you a realized volatility of 3 to 4% a year and an expected return of only 2% a year. So the use of leverage is to try to get that combination of assets back to a risk level that's more commensurate with a 60-40 portfolio, about 10% a year, and a return level that's higher, about 5 to 6% a year. And that's pretty important because we know that helps you obtain your investment objectives and your return objectives. Keep in mind that leverage is one of the tools out there that we believe can be used, but it has a lot of risks associated with it as well. And so one of the key things for any risk parity manager like ourselves is that we spend a lot of time thinking about risk management and how to use leverage responsibly. So we think leverage is a good tool that can help us build better portfolios, but we have to be sure to mitigate the risks that come with leverage. And that's something that features prominently in the way that we run the risk parity strategy and then with the way that we design the portfolio. In fact, going back to my first point on this page, which is to say that because we size the portfolio holdings very differently depending on the risk environment, you'll see that when volatility is high in the markets, our dollar exposures tend to be much lower. And when volatility is lower in the markets, you'll tend to see our exposures being much higher. Right? So if you contrast, for example, the financial crisis period when volatility was very high to the 2014 period, the second and third graph here, you'll see that the exposures in the 2008 period add up to about 100%. So there wasn't really much leverage that you needed to use in 2008 to build a risk parity portfolio because markets were so risky that with even a fewer dollars invested in each of these asset classes, the entire combination was pretty much at a 10% level of volatility because each dollar that you invested was moving around a lot more. Whereas if you look at 2014, because each dollar that you invest tends to behave in a much more subdued manner, you need to put in more dollars or get more dollar exposure to the three asset classes to get the same level of risk. So importantly, when you look at the portfolios illustrated on this page, this is not a reflection of AQR deciding that bonds are more attractive in 2014 versus 2008 or 1980. In all of these three portfolios, we are trying to achieve the same exact objective, which is to have the same risk allocation across stocks, bonds, and inflation, a third each. So in each of these three scenarios, the risk allocation to stocks, bonds, and commodities are exactly the same. And moreover, the risk level that we're trying to achieve at the fund level is also exactly the same. It's 10% a year. The only reason why these holdings vary quite dramatically is because market conditions vary dramatically. And again, that goes back to our central point of how we're differentiated in our approach. We believe that if one was just to run a risk parity strategy that was static in nature, where we didn't change the exposures, we just held a fixed amount of weights in stocks, bonds, and inflation, that portfolio could actually become quite unbalanced in an environment when risks of different asset classes vary dramatically. So for example, the reason why we use the 1980 example is to point out one of the time periods where bonds were actually more risky than stocks. It's hard to imagine today because for the last 20 years, stocks have been much more risky than bonds in terms of how they move, the size of the drawdowns, the day-to-day volatility. But in 1980, when interest rates were in the teens, bonds actually moved around a lot more than stocks. So every dollar you put in bonds was actually more risky than a dollar that you put in stocks. So in our way of constructing risk parity, the holdings that we would have in 1980 was that we had fewer dollars invested in bonds than we did in equities. And again, this is not because we thought bonds were less attractive or more attractive as an investment. In all these three scenarios, our belief is that we want to be equally risk-weighted across the three asset classes. It just turns out that in 1980, you need much fewer dollars in bonds to get the same risk in bonds than you do today, because each dollar was a lot more risky. So that's really the nature of the dynamic way that we construct risk parity, means that the portfolio becomes quite adaptable. And depending, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what the world will be like in a few years. It could be the case that fixed income volatility, which has been extremely low for a long time, gets heightened because of inflation fears or because of a more aggressive rate hiking regime. Our portfolio and our systematic process is designed in that scenario, if interest rates get a lot more volatile, to naturally reduce the amount of holdings we have in bonds in that environment. And it will do so on a systematic basis in order to try to keep the risks of the portfolio balanced so that we don't become overweight in bond risk when that happens. I know that's a lot to go through, so I'm happy to sort of hear if there are any questions or anything on this concept of risk balancing. But that's a very key differentiator and a key feature of what we try to do here, which is in order to try to keep risks stable over time, we actually have to be very active in how we move around the portfolio exposures every day.
Any questions? Okay.
All right, so if there are no questions on that, I'll go to page 23. And just to give you a review of the performance of the strategy over the last 12 years or so. So just to point out what these returns are, on the left side, the first column is the returns of the fund that we're proposing today, the GRPEL fund. And the second category is an extension of those returns all the way back to 2006 using the first version of risk parity that Joey mentioned that we started in 2006. The reason why there are two versions is because in 2006 we ran a version of the fund that also included credit as an additional fourth exposure, but we launched in 2011 a version of our strategy that had more liquidity and had less credit. And the reasons for doing so were related to credit having less capacity and also the fact that our investors wanted a more liquid and more diversified allocation. And we believe that the GRPEL strategy had lower correlations, lower exposures to growth assets like equities and credit, and served that purpose. When we look over the full track record, we basically see that the strategy has achieved over the long term its objective of delivering a solid return over cash, in excess of cash, and doing so in a way that's diversified to a traditional 60/40. So I'll kind of end with those remarks unless there are any additional questions from you guys.
Any questions, Fergus? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
4 years on the volleyball team, that's impressive.
I was the shortest one on the team. But it was a good 4 years.
That's quite an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.